Vectis Radio, FM 104.6. Our broadcasters are all ages and abilities. This is what makes us your local station. VectisRadio.com.
Hello, I'm Joan Ellis, and I'd like to welcome you to this very special edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls, entitled Dementia Stole My Mum. The illness robbed me of her, but not of my memories of her. I would like to share some of those moments with you and talk about Mum's struggle with dementia, its devastating impact, the miracle of getting her back just for one day, and the life-affirming kindness of strangers, carers, friends and family along the way. I must stress this is a very personal account, reflecting only my experience, thoughts and emotions. Dementia, like so many fatal illnesses, presents in many different ways. Anyone touched by this condition has their own unique story. This is Mum's. Joan Ellis, Senior, Nee Gorringe, or Little Orange as she was known at school, was born on the 8th of October 1926 and died 3rd of January 2018. She was 91 and weighed a little over 4 stone. She had a good innings. A good life, people say when they don't know what to say. I watched dementia rip my mum apart, sending in the Grim Reaper a good 5 years before she died to do his worst, robbing her of her memory, her dignity, and eventually her life. I had no idea the illness was capable of such cruelty. I hated that it robbed her of her memory, slowly erasing my mum from our lives. I hated that it took away her dignity. She had no idea where she was, or even how to paint and draw. Once a talented artist, she could only produce childlike scribbles. Worse still, she could no longer remember how to make a cup of tea, or even how to go to the toilet. When it robbed her of the ability to speak, there were no words. Yet there was far worse to come, and we had no way of knowing what fresh hell awaited Mum. Looking back, I wonder if we should have been grateful for that, or would it have been better to have known to prepare ourselves? At least we had made happy memories when we could. Just a shame those memories were lost to Mum. When a psychiatrist eventually diagnosed Alzheimer's, I knew no treatment could make a significant difference to the outcome of the illness. There is no cure, and it's not for the want of trying. Research scientists work tirelessly in the hope of a breakthrough. But it's too late for Mum and countless others like her who have lost their lives to this devastating condition. I struggled to cope. Each day we were losing another aspect of my mum and there was nothing I could do. I wanted to make it stop, but it was out of my control. There was nothing any of us could do but love and care for Mum as we watched her disappear from view. Unable to do anything to prevent her demise, I did the only thing I knew how to. I wrote about it. This poem is called Simply Mum. Which way was I looking when I lost my mother? What second did she leave? I never noticed. Perhaps I did not wish to see the sending money to countless so-called charities, crooks who took her pension and took advantage. The day she turned left instead of right when she exited the bank, a place she had visited for over 50 years, withdrawing and replacing meagre amounts. When she returned, pale and thirsty on swollen purple feet, having walked for hours on sun-seared pavements, she could not explain. I made her tea, relieved she was home. We were together, but alone. This year, Mum forgot my birthday. I wasn't sad the day had slipped her mind. Just upset she could no longer remember the cake she had baked on stifling August afternoons, bent over the cooker melting chocolate. The gift she had saved for but could ill afford. Tiny silver ballet shoes on a chain. A wicker sewing basket and silk threads with which to reweave broken dreams. I wonder, are her memories stowed away the key broken in the lock, or have they slipped away unseen like shadows silently escaping underfoot? I shared my cake. Happy she was safe in my home. We were together, but alone. My mum's sharp, never misses a trick. She's not ill, she's old, I reassured. I'll get it in a minute, she said, struggling to recall my daughter's name. It begins with S, Nana, said Sophie. Susie, Mum replied, recalling the name of her first pet. Retired from her paper round, aged 80. Her job every day for 30 years, hand smeared a newsprint, walking the streets, delivering to those who never knew her face, who did not care when she slipped and fell on pavements laminated with ice, so long as they didn't have to risk their necks. When she got pneumonia, she refused to eat or drink. Three doctors came, and she turned her head away. And I cried in the kitchen, arguing with my father on the phone. Call you. How can I talk to you when my mum is too sick to speak? Want me to say something to her? 10 years estranged. Never a word between them. I often wonder what he said, but I did hear her reply. Okay, darling. Yes, I will. The man she had loved all her life made it right, but they never spoke again. I made her tea. She drank it. We were together, both of us alone. Talk to me, Mum, my words falling like stones into the sea. I want her back, the woman who made me, the woman who made me who I am, whoever that may be. I smile. She nods. I make her tea. She forgets to drink it. We are together. Soon I will be alone. Writing that final line took me up short at the time. It was true, too true. I performed that poem with Mum in the audience. She knew I was on stage, showing off, as she would have called it, but not the meaning of the words. She wore sunglasses even though it was evening, and at the end of the show, the audience mobbed her, stroking her like a cat, and she lapped up the attention, milking the moment for all it was worth. Brilliant. There is no good way to die, and certainly no good way to lose your mother, the woman who's been there for you every day of your life and would certainly have laid down hers for you. I'll be honest, I'm angry. Angry with dementia, Alzheimer's, whatever guise it takes. I'm sure you can hear the bitterness in my voice. For destroying Mum, taking her from me and leaving her without a shred of dignity. Dementia's a beast. One you can't battle. It's fatal. Britain's biggest killer, affecting 1 in 6 people and an estimated 850,000 people in Britain. There's no known cure. And despite all the research, we know relatively little about it. But I do know what it did to my mum. It started about 5 years ago. I say about because there were no clear-cut signs or symptoms. Just some quirky behaviour that I put down to her age. Always delightfully eccentric, she was in her 80s and had earned the right to live her life however she wished. Since her divorce, she'd become a hoarder and kept boxes of our possessions under her bed in the hope my father would one day come for us. Sadly, it wasn't to be, but the boxes remained, unpacked, a constant reminder of the past. As time went on, the chaos spread, and she filled her living room with bulging carrier bags. She was intensely private and independent. For years I had no idea what was in those bags. Whenever I offered to help her clear them, her answer was always the same. No, mind your own business and don't interfere. As time went by, the bags multiplied, making negotiating a path from the door to a chair virtually impossible. For the first time, Mum looked vulnerable, almost defeated. Would you like us to help you tidy this lot up, Mum? Oh, yes, please, she replied, her relief almost palpable. And there the nightmare began. My daughter, Sophie, and I opened envelope after envelope, stuffed full of cash and cheques, money she could ill afford to so-called charities and lotteries, few of which proved bona fide. We filled 3 bin liners with evidence to take to the police in the hope of exposing the con artists. It was depressing work. I had all but given up when my daughter insisted on opening one more envelope. Thank goodness she did. She found a cheque for my mother's life savings, as meagre as they were. The only reason she had any money at all was because she never spent anything on herself. Never drank or smoked or ran a car. She was from the era of make do amend, and Mum lived that life to the letter. We got the CID involved, but there was nothing they could do, as the companies were registered offshore. In an effort to help, they did send uniform officers to speak to Mum, in the hope of explaining that her pension was not helping a good cause, as she hoped, but funding bad people to do bad things. She promised she would stop, but the very next day was back signing cheques. My mum had always been so smart, no one's fool, yet here she was hemorrhaging money. What was going on? Looking back, I think that was the start. On the advice of a good friend, I got power of attorney to safeguard Mum's finances. She'd worked too hard and gone without for too long to let some tricksters con her out of her savings. But I hated taking control. It was her money, not mine. I felt like I was betraying her, a feeling I was to become all too familiar with. How could I take charge of my mother's life? We trusted each other implicitly, always there when I needed her, never tiring of my offloading, moaning, groaning. I told her my fears, hopes and joys. She cared, really cared, like only a mother can. If she was bored, poorly or tired, she never showed it. One hot summer's day, when dementia was still something that happened to other people, I had been to see her as I did most weeks. She'd always refused to have a phone of any sort, so we communicated by letter. As usual, I'd sent her a note to let her know the date and time of my visit, but when I put my key in the door, there was no sign of her. I waited for 3 hours. I was worried. She only ever went as far as the local shops and hated being out in the heat. Eventually, she showed up, having turned the wrong way when leaving the bank, ending up miles away and walking home. I put it down to the excess of building work in the area. All those new structures being thrown up overnight surely would confuse anyone. But why hadn't she caught the bus home or taken a cab? She never left the house again on her own. Her decision, and a wise one. We upped our visits and did her shopping, but she still insisted on remaining fiercely independent. What I saw as helping, Mum thought of as interference. She loved the Isle of Wight where we lived. I brought her here from London on endless holidays. I thought of it as rescuing her, but no matter how hard we tried to persuade her to move here, she always insisted on going home. The day I turned up at her house to find virtually all the food I had left her the previous week untouched, I knew something was badly wrong. I was shaking as I called my husband and asked him to come and get us. When we took her to the doctor, she sat in his big leather chair and did a wheelie round the room. He perched on the patient's seat and asked her to draw a clock face with the hands set at 20 to 4, apparently a classic test for diagnosing dementia. Mum drew the circle and added in the numbers on the right-hand side, 12 to 6. Triumphant, she handed it back, her task complete. Or so she thought. She was referred to a psychiatrist who came to the house to assess her. Despite being in the grasp of dementia, Mum did a great job of trying to mask it. "Where are you?" asked the doctor. "Here," she replied, looking him straight in the eye. Exasperated, he tried again. "And how long have you been here?" She looked at the clock. "About 10 minutes. She was quite literally playing for time. I loved her chutzpah, but it wasn't about to save her from a diagnosis of Alzheimer's. And the directive that it was time for her to go into full-time residential care. At least she would be looked after by professionals, and this was the one thing, though, that my mother had always made me promise I would never do. Put her in a home. You see, I knew why she dreaded it so much. Mum was a home girl, an orphan who had lost her mother when she was just 2 years old. Her father had had to continue work and was unable to look after her or younger brother Leonard. The two children were placed in separate orphanages, mum and the girls, Len and the boys. Only minimal contact with each other or their father was allowed, as if losing their mother wasn't cruel enough. It may have been the 1930s, but from the stories mum told me, the place was run on strict Victorian lines. Their father, on his monthly visit, took the children to the pictures and bought them treats. They were invariably late back. Mum would run upstairs to her room to escape the wrath of matron, only for the sweets her father had bought her to fall out of her knicker legs where she had stashed her contraband. As punishment, she was locked in an unlit basement with only cockroaches for company. She was just 4 years old. No wonder she hated the idea of being institutionalised again. Thank you for listening. I'll be back after this break with more memories of mum and the devastating effects of dementia.
Vectis Radio, FM 104.6, Isle of Wight's community station.
I felt like I was betraying her when I signed her into full-time residential care and found little comfort in the psychiatrist assuring me we had granted her wish and enabled her to live independently for years. Had it not been for us, he said, she would have ended up in care long ago. He asked me if I wanted to be put in touch with the Admiral Nurse Service here on the island. I had heard Mr. Ron Holland, former High Sheriff, speak about his personal experience of dementia and the key role that Admiral Nurses play in the care of both patients and carers. Following the appeal to bring Admiral Nurses to the Isle of Wight, initiated by Lady Sally Grills, a champion for dementia care on the island, we now have a handful of Admiral Nurses trained and supported by the charity Dementia UK. They aid the physical and emotional well-being of people with dementia and their carers, giving them one-to-one support, expert guidance and practical solutions. They sounded just what I needed, and I jumped at the chance of having one. Part of the NHS-funded service, Admiral Nurse Jasmine Stant was a godsend, holding my hand and supporting us throughout. When the emotional and physical toll of being there for mum and watching her demise became too much, Jasmine provided a lifeline. When she first met mum, she did her best to engage with her and used picture books and photos to get mum interested. But mum didn't want to know. Racking my brain for something, anything, to ignite mum, I told Jasmine she'd always liked to waltz. "Would you like to partner me, Joan?" My mum smiled and nodded, got to her feet. Together they danced like no one was watching. Beautiful. I'm so grateful to Jasmine. She visited mum when I couldn't and liaised with healthcare professionals on our behalf. Most importantly, I was able to tell her how I really felt. The anger at the illness, the devastation at watching mum ebb away from me. I cried, laughed and shared memories, telling her what a wonderful woman my mother had been. Not always the silent shadow in the chair, sipping tea through a straw. "Thank you, Jasmine," I said. "But I don't feel I do enough," she replied. "Oh, you do more than you will ever know," I told her. When we moved Mum into the care home, it felt, at first, like a weight had been lifted. With all her personal care needs met, we could really enjoy our time with her. Take her for cream teas, days on the beach, picnics in the park. But these halcyon times never materialised. We tried, taking her by cab to a nearby beach cafe, one of her favourite places. But the short journey terrified her, and when we got to the restaurant, she clung to the edge of the table, as if fearing she might fall off a cliff. As I said, she'd always loved dancing, so we hired in a dance troupe to come to the home and entertain mum and the other residents. Loved it. Taking to the floor in the arms of a handsome man, she may not have cut the rug she did back in the 20s, but skipping the light fantastic, she was wreathed in smiles. I offered a dance with her. She shook her head. I wasn't surprised. She'd always said I had no sense of rhythm. Visited her virtually every day, taking chocolates and flowers, showing her photos, sharing memories, holding her hand and telling her we loved her, but in the end all we could really do was watch. Watch as she struggled to remember my daughter's name. Watch as she stopped speaking altogether. Watch as dementia erased my mother's brain. I could never fault the love the carers had for Mum. They clearly adored her and worked hard to meet all the resident needs. But it was the little things, like the way she wore her hair, that upset me. Before her illness, she'd prided herself on her style. But once in the home, her bright blonde Betty Grable curls became a long grey ponytail or plait. Reluctantly, I had to admit it would have been cruel to subject her to sitting for almost an hour, swamped with cold, wet hair dye, simply so I could have my glamorous mum back. But it broke my heart when I turned up one afternoon to discover Mum looking traumatised. Some well-meaning soul had washed and blow-dried her hair and secured it in a taut, tight bun. I could only imagine her confusion, unspeaking, unable to protest about the sopping wet hair, the loudness of the dryer. She hadn't used one in over 40 years, preferring to finger-dry her hair in front of the fire. The intense heat, or the strict, straight brushing. "Thank you," I told her carer. "That was kind of you, but please don't do it again." Another time, on a cold winter's day, I arrived in fake fur to find Mum dressed in just a petticoat. I wrapped her in woolens, urging those in charge to ensure she stayed well covered. After all, she only had one lung and was susceptible to chest infections. She'd survived pneumonia once. Next time, she might not be so lucky. Yet here she was, dressed for a summer's day in the height of winter. Other times, I would visit to find her wearing someone else's clothes, a massive vest or ill-fitting skirt, pieces my mum would never have chosen. Magical times were few and far between, but they did exist. My great-nephew came with me to visit. His autism and Mum's dementia, no barrier to their friendship. They hit it off straight away, with beaming smiles, fits of giggles, and holding each other's hand. A rare and beautiful connection between people understood each other perfectly, no matter what. Another day, a carer brought her kitten to work, leaving it in the sitting room with just Mum for company. Moments later, the woman returned to hear her talking to the cat. Sometimes she would softly sing along to hymns or Doris Day numbers. This from the lady who hadn't uttered a word in over a year. Months later, after being forced to move care homes when her original one closed, she contracted pneumonia again. Dehydrated and frail, she was admitted to St Mary's Hospital. With only one lung and weighing just over 4 stone, her chances didn't look good. Not wanting to cry in front of her, I ran into a storeroom. A nurse came and hugged me. "It's okay, you've done your best." I'll never forget her kindness. Yet how could I forgive myself for the years I'd spent mourning Mum while she was still alive, as I was robbed of her bit by bit? I couldn't deny it, the day was approaching when the grieving would start for real, yet I still clung to every shred of hope. Thanks to intravenous antibiotics and the care of the staff at St Mary's Hospital, Mum recovered. I kidded myself she'd turned a corner, a belief that gathered momentum the day my daughter and I arrived to find the curtains closed around her bed and a nurse calling out that Mum was as bright as a button. When the curtain came back, there was Mum. My mum, Sophie's nana, Archie's great-nana, not the wretched woman dementia had tormented on a daily basis for the past 5 years. She was smiling, laughing, talking, hallelujah. I convinced myself she was back for good. At least Sophie had the presence of mind to film her grandmother saying, "I love you." The next day we rushed back, eager to see yet more progress, only to find Mum slumped unresponsively in her chair, her beaker of tea untouched. Later, I was told, we got Mum back fleetingly because of the antibiotics. Apparently, it happens sometimes. We were lucky to have had that magical moment when she finally got to play with her grandson, Archie. When the specialist took us into a side room and told us Mum had days, weeks, possibly 1 month to live, Sophie and I clung to each other. Mum was a fighter. She would take it to the wire. And she did, holding up for 5 weeks. She even hung on over Christmas and New Year, once her favourite time. When we learned she was going to the Earl Mountbatten Hospice, it felt as if she'd been rescued and wrapped in love. Mum never had much luck in her life, but here she was being afforded the most dignified and serene end I could have wished for her. Her illness had been hideous, tragic, unexpected, and unremitting. Yet that same illness had uncovered compassion, love, and care in spades. I remember being at her bedside at the hospice as the nurses dressed her. One asked what her favourite song was. I began singing, "I Just Called to Say I Love You" by Stevie Wonder. The nurse joined in. Within moments, another nurse was playing the original track on her phone. "No one should have to listen to those two, Joan," she said, handing Mum her mobile. "Here, you keep my phone for the day and enjoy your music." She had paid to download the album out of her own purse. I offered to reimburse her. "No, I wanted to do it," she replied. That's nursing care at its very best. Other staff at the hospice told me Mum spoke with her eyes and understood what was being said to her, always following simple instructions to the letter. Sometimes her illness felt like a kind of locked-in syndrome where it seemed she knew what people were saying but was unable to respond, a thought I find both comforting and chilling. What if she had heard all the things said to her and about her? People talking over her bed, thinking she was oblivious, letting slip a careless word, a thoughtless remark. I hate to think she was hurt or frightened in any way. Yet how wonderful to imagine that she had heard all the words of love, the funny stories, the recounting of special memories. The nurses even brought a pony. Yes, a pony. Into the hospice reception for Mum to stroke. And when the harpist came to play, they wheeled Mum in to watch. I was told her face lit up. As Mum became frailer, the Earl Mountbatten hospice priest, Rosie, knew just what to say to give comfort. Like an angel, she always appeared when I needed her the most. Mum had her last Christmas at the hospice. I decorated her room with a small pink Christmas tree, a nod to the wonderful Christmas decorations she had put up in the one room we'd called home. I'd brought her great-grandson Arch in to see her. I held him in my arms and showed him the tree. Carefully, he lifted the fairy off the top, wriggled free, and walked over to Mum. Then he took her hand and gently placed the doll in her palm, furling her fingers round it. He looked at her, waited for her to return his gaze, and then smiled. A Christmas miracle. Christmas Day was difficult, knowing it would be her last. Sophie and I knelt beside her and told her we loved her, recounted stories from Christmases past. We squeezed her hand and cried. When we eventually left, I noticed the tins of sweets at reception. Any other time, Mum would have made short work of them, but now she was being risk-fed, tiny spoonfuls of pureed food or sips of liquid administered by a trained nurse, lest she choked. Dementia had dealt its final blow and robbed her of the ability to swallow. Cruel to the last, no reprieve. On January the 3rd, I woke to a missed call from the hospice. Hand shaking, I rang them. "Mum had changed," they said. "We should all come." By midday, my daughter, my husband and I were there with Mum. Knowing it would be our last opportunity, we held her hand tighter than ever and impressed on her how much we loved her. We smiled, holding back the tears so as not to alarm her. I had flu, constantly coughing and blowing my nose. How could I be ill? Mum couldn't wait for me to recover. Her condition was incurable and her time had come. A nurse arrived and asked if we wanted someone with us. I declined. When Mum died, I wanted it to be our moment, our private farewell. If we needed to scream and rail, that was our prerogative. We didn't want a witness. The priest came and anointed Mum's head, said prayers over her, and offered words of real comfort. I was never so glad to have faith. The faith my Mum had instilled in me years ago when I was her little girl. At the very end, she was like a prize racehorse, desperate to make the finish line. Yet there was no victory to be had as she strained to catch her last breath. We told her we loved her. She'd done enough. She could let go. It was okay. But it wasn't. It wasn't the least bit okay. I wanted her back. In that moment, I wanted a cure. Right there, right then. But it wasn't to be. Just before she died, Mum turned her head and smiled at Sophie, her beloved granddaughter. Her last action was one of pure love. Thank you for listening. I'll be straight back after this break with how we coped with her death and my final words to my mum. Thank you.
Vectis Radio, FM 104.6, your station, your community.
Hello and welcome back to part three of Dementia Stole My Mum. After Mum died, we stayed with her for 3 hours. Her eyes closed, she looked like she was sleeping peacefully as we reminisced, raged, cried, and goodness knows how, laughed. Where was the roadmap for the rest of our lives? We'd never had to cope without her. Where to begin? I cannot thank Nigel Hartley, Chief Executive Officer at the Earl Mountbatten Hospice, enough. He was kindness itself, showing Mum and our family real humanity and care when we needed it the most. Mum would have loved him. Admiral Nurse Jill George supported us too. Her post is a partnership between Earl Mountbatten Hospice and Dementia UK and came about due to the generosity of the island community and tireless fundraising efforts of Lady Sally Grills, who, as I said earlier in the programme, is a champion for dementia care on the island. Based at the hospice, Jill delivers palliative care and works in the community supporting people to live as well as they can with terminal illness. I will always remember her kindness, expertise and compassion. The funeral was at our local church, just across the road from where we live. A beautiful, simple service. Preparing the eulogy, I wanted people to know the woman Mum was. The whole person, not just the little lady with dementia shrinking with each passing year. My mum had been witty, pretty, bright and beautiful, smart, no one's fool. Jeff Leather, funeral director, ensured Mum got the send-off she deserved, and wonderful friends and family came to show their respects. It was like having an army in the pews behind us, ready to shore us up if we collapsed. Walking behind her coffin at the end of the service, my legs buckled, but standing unsteadily at the graveside, cleaving to my daughter, the sun broke through the clouds and sheep in the neighbouring field peered through the hedge. Mum, you finally have your sea view, I wanted to tell her as I looked out over the coastline. We held the wake at the Sun Inn, a beautiful thatch pub with views across the ocean, and played Mum's Nat King Cole LPs. Her favourite song was Unforgettable. She was certainly that. The graveyard is moments from my home. I drive past it most days. Sometimes I feel strong enough to lay flowers and talk to her. Other times, it's too difficult. And I prefer to imagine her in a cottage, set just out of view behind the hedge, cup of tea in hand, cat on her lap. I wave, blow a kiss, and call out, I love you. Although I feel like I've been grieving the loss of Mum for years, another type of mourning has begun. A flatness, an emptiness, a rage interspersed with laughter and happy memories. We all deal with grief in different ways. Sophie tells me the little lady she watched die was not her grandmother. No, her little Nana is still at her house, in Haven Lane, doing a crossword, eating chocolate and waiting for Sophie's visit. People have suggested Mum's death may be a relief or release for me. No way. I'd give anything to be visiting her right now, holding her hand, telling her I love her and eating all her pink wafers. Mum still looks after me, inspires me. I use her mixing bowl to make cakes with Archie. The best thing I can do in her memory is to be as good a nana to that little boy as she was to my daughter. A tough act to follow, but I'm determined to dance in her footsteps, even if I am beat. I would like to leave you with my final words to Mum, the eulogy. Goodbye, Mum. Thank you for everything. For my life, Sophie's and Archie's. For being a wonderful Mum, the best little Nicky Nana Sophie could wish for. There. You gave us your heart. You gave gifts and went without yourself. You gave us your love, a love of the island, the place we now call home, the sea, scenery and wildlife. Most importantly, you gave us the love of cream teas, cake and chocolate. That's how you taught me to work. Remember, tempting me across the room with a bar of milk chocolate. Just the will to succeed and the strength to carry on. You led by example, working long hours for Lopez, as a nurse, making Christmas crackers, delivering the Christmas post, and finally doing a paper round until you were 80 years old. You gave us glamour and a sense of style, never leaving home without your trademark red lipstick. You let us have all manner of pets, rabbits that turned your rose garden into a warren and cats that had kittens inside the sofa. Do you remember that time Blossom, our pedigree poodle, went to the beauty parlour? You left her there and Philip, Peter and I collected her. Where's Blossom, you asked when we got home. The lady in the shop said, "This is her," we chorused, bursting in tears at the sight of the creature we had brought back. More pig than dog, the woman had switched our pedigree for an old mutt. You went down and tried to argue your case, but she stood firm. And you did what you always did. Took in the new girl, warts and all. You gave us you, always there, waiting with a cup of tea and a smile. You never did see the point of a tea strainer, something I would only ever remember as I choked on yet another mouthful of PG tips. You gave us love, laughter and wonderful memories. When I was 5, I couldn't spell. On failing yet another test, my teacher, a fiery nun, told me I was a stupid girl. And I told her she didn't know how to teach. I was only repeating what you'd said to me every time I returned home with yet another zero scrawled across my work. But you'd never intended that comment for a broadcast. You got hauled up in front of the head, Sister Mary Hedwig, and bravely took the opportunity to share your theory that little children learn through play, not in dank, soulless classrooms. Back home, you let me scrawl the words over and over again on your formica top table before testing me. And once you ticked them all, you simply wiped it clean. Despite never having any money, you always made Christmas special, transforming our dingy one room into a little palace. Every year you insisted on a real tree with a root so we could once again experience the festive disappointment of planting it on the 6th of January, only to see it wither by the 16th. One holiday on the Isle of Wight, Philip, Peter, you and me were on Fisherman's Cove when we got cut off from the steps by the tide. The only way to safety was up the cliff. The boys and I were soon at the top, but you were wearing your Dr. Skull sandals. We giggled helplessly at your attempts to conquer the cliff face. Quick thinking, Peter threw down his plimsolls. You donned his size 9s like flippers on your tiny feet and somehow made it to the top, only to be greeted by a wild boar that chased you all the way to Orchard Bay. Once I started work, we enjoyed meeting up for treats. We loved the theatre and cinema, but our favourite was always afternoon tea. One day in a cramped cafe in Richmond, we argued over who was going to pour and ended up wrestling the ridiculously large pot. Both stubborn, neither of us would let go. Before we knew it, the spout was pointing south and hot tea gushing all over the table. As it cascaded over the edge, we could only watch as it splashed up the unsuspecting trouser legs and skirts of fellow diners. We were useless, doubled over, legs crossed, tummies aching from joyous, silent laughter, desperately trying not to catch each other's eye for fear of letting out another schoolgirl screech. When Sophie was little, you never tired of playing games with her. Schools was a favourite, with Sophie naturally casting herself in the role of headmistress, and you as Mary, the classroom assistant, whose sole responsibility was to sharpen pencils. Before we moved to the island, we holidayed here, and the pair of you would play shops on Orchard Bay. Sophie was invariably the shopkeeper, you the customer. She'd set out her stall on a rock, with pebbles for products. 6 smooth stones were half a dozen eggs, which you would ask to buy. Ever helpful, Sophie would tell you. Eggs? Oh, sorry, we're out of stock. When you'd point them out and ask the price, she'd reply, they're £20. Ooh, £20? That's a lot. I'll have to leave it. Thank you. You never did tire of that game, or the shopkeeper's cavalier treatment of you. Neither Sophie nor I will ever forget the day she sat on your knee and asked you to list your favourite things. Without hesitation, you said Mickey your dog, tea, fillet steak, being born, your ex-husband, my father, and love of your life, Bill, and tomato juice. No mention of Sophie, your beloved granddaughter, let alone me. You always came to Sophie's birthday parties when she was little. My old school friend Vera, who you'd known since she was 11, was always kind enough to drive you home. One time I made egg mayonnaise sandwiches, but instead of using bridge rolls, as you'd have done, I put the filling between two pieces of challah bread. It was too sweet for you, a fact you drove home to Vera on the 40-minute drive home. When Sophie was 15, she became seriously ill. The morning she came out of hospital, she slept for hours with you, watching quietly over her. It was dark by the time you came downstairs and announced, "She will be fine now." And she was. You were always such a calming influence, Mum. I remember cutting my fingers and waiting for stitches at St Mary's A&E. In an effort to help, my husband Doug had cantilevered the bed shut with me in it, then panicked and gave my bad hand a reassuring squeeze. I hit the roof, literally, and suggested he might want to go and repark the car in Edinburgh. With Doug safely out the way, you sat with me. No drama, no words, just a gentle hand on my arm. You were tiny, just 4'9", but you had so much courage and strength, you needed it. Because it felt to me like you'd battled your whole life. From that little girl in the orphanage sent to a cockroach-infested basement as punishment for tucking sweets up her nickel egg, to my mum taking on a formidable headmistress, and standing up and winning against a greedy landlord. He took you to the court and used every trick in the book to try and evict you. Your barrister even took me to one side and ordered me to tell you to take his offer of a run-down one-bedroom flat miles from anywhere, because you had no chance of winning. Foolishly, I put the suggestion to you. You told me if it was the only support I could offer, I should leave. You then went back into that courtroom, took the stand, told the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. When you'd finished, the judge said you could stay in your home forever, and your hard-bitten barrister, with tears in her eyes, simply nodded. "What just happened?" you asked, confused by all the cheering. "You won, Mum. You won." I remember coming home from school one day to find the place awash with flowers, blooms in every sink, bowl, receptacle, including the kettle. Apparently, you'd returned a wallet you'd found on your paper round to the police station, and the grateful owner had turned up on your doorstep with armfuls of bouquets, having spent every penny in his wallet on flowers for you. The gratitude you deserved, but so rarely received. You had integrity, patience and calmness. You did your best to pass those qualities on to me, but they passed me by. You were always the better person, Mum. Thank you for the faith you gave me that shores me up in times of trouble, never more so than now. Yet despite being this wonderful person, you always claimed to be nothing and no one. And every time you said that you were nothing and no one, you broke my heart. Because to me, to all of us, you were everything. Quite the opposite of no one. You were our number one. Thank you for everything, Mummy. We will love you forever and see you again one day. Until then, I am comforted that you will be reunited with your own mother, who you lost when you were just 2 years old. She's waited a long time, 89 years, to take care of you. Goodbye, and God bless, Mummy. When the worst happens, it's comforting to know that there is someone there to help pick up the pieces. You're not alone. The Earl Mountbatten Hospice has a professional bereavement counselling service, and Crewe's Bereavement Care offer somewhere to turn when someone dies. If you have any questions about dementia, Admiral Nurses, or if you would like to make a donation to Dementia UK, please contact 0800 888 6678. That's 0800 888 6678. As a way of thanking the countless people who touched Mum's life during her illness, I'd continue to fundraise for Dementia UK and the Earl Mountbatten Hospice. I'm performing with Donna Jones MBE at the hospice Thursday, April the 19th at 7 p.m. Come along, have a laugh and a glass of wine and some legendary canapés apparently, all for just £10, with every penny going to the Earl Mountbatten Hospice to enable them to continue to support those living with terminal illness. If anyone is listening who's been affected by dementia, my advice, for what it's worth, is to take any help offered. Cherish the memories you have and make new, happy memories whenever you can with your loved one. And always remember, any odd behaviour is not them. It's the illness. They are still there with you somewhere. And they need you now more than ever. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you about my mum and bringing her back to life and telling you what a brilliant lady she was. It's helped me, and I hope it's helped you. It's helped me remember the woman she was, not that little lady that she became, so sick and so unwell, so dependent on others for her care, for her support and for her love. Because Mum was never that person. She was always, like I said, so fiercely independent. I can remember when I left, one of my partners left me and I was in a terrible state. I'd been up all night tearing my hair out. And I went to see Mum and she looked me straight in the eye the next morning. She said, "Darling, no wonder he left you. Look at the state of your hair." So she kind of had such a great personality. She would always tell you how it was. And she was my mum and she was fab. So thank you again for taking the time to listen to this show. I'll be back here next week with my guest, ex-Royal Ballet dancer and counsellor Terry Hyde. I look forward to talking to you very soon. Have a lovely weekend. Take care. Enjoy life. Embrace it. Have fun. And have a laugh. Thank you so much. I've been Joan Ellis. And this has been my show, Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls. And this has been a one-off edition, Dementia Stole My Mother. Thank you again for listening. Take care. Bye-bye.